Theological education should be accessible. In the past, men have had to leave their local churches to train for the ministry. At Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, you can now complete a seminary education while staying in your own church and being mentored by your own pastor. For more information on how you can receive informed scholarship with Pastoral Heart, check out our website, cbtseminary.org.
You are listening to the Weekly Discourse on the Man of God Network, featuring a weekly lecture from the classroom of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary.
So, having said all of that, now we come to the issue, which is actually stated in the subtitle of Hill's book, Regnum Caelorum, Patterns of Millennial Thought in Early Christianity. The major discussion about eschatology, the major bone of contention regarding the early church and among church historians, involves the issue of premillennialism. Now, this is one of those great big words and technical terms that has emerged in the course of the great conversation about eschatology in the church. Premillennialism was refined and developed in a couple of major ways in the history of the church. Those refinements and developments come later in the conversation. But in the early church, it's important to define this premillennialism in terms of, its basic essentials. What are the basic essentials of premillennialism? Well, premillennialism is essentially the belief that, Christ will return prior to a thousand-year reign of Christ on earth that will take place before the final and eternal state is ushered in. Let me get this diagram all in one place for you. Here's basic premillennialism then. You have the Old Covenant, the Old Testament period. You have the resurrection, which brings in the gospel age. You have the return of Christ. And the return of Christ does not bring in the final judgment or the eternal state. There is an interregnum. That is to say, an intermediate reign. In the millennium, Christ reigns on earth, and this thousand-year period of time precedes the final judgment and the eternal state. Now, that is premillennialism boiled down to its most basic essentials. Now, it assumes that whole thing assumes a number of other things in terms of how it has to exegete and understand certain passages of Scripture, but that's premillennialism. Okay? Now, with regard to premillennialism in the early church, extraordinary claims have been made. Perhaps the most extraordinary is by a very well-known evangelical theologian, Dr. Charles Feinberg, there are several Feinbergs, this is Charles, and he asserted in one of his books that the entire early church of the first three centuries was premillennial almost to a man. Now, that's a slap in the face if you're not a premillennialist. That's a real encouragement if you are, I suppose. Now, if this statement were accurate, it would have great significance for us. You don't have to be Catholic and believe in the authority of early tradition or the tradition of the church to be impressed by the fact that if that statement were true, it would create some presumption in favor of premillennialism, right? It's well known that Roman Catholics place a faith in the traditions of the early church that Protestants refuse to give them. But even Protestants can appreciate this. William Cunningham was a Scottish Presbyterian, and I'm quite confident, very anti-Catholic in the old Scottish Presbyterian way. And yet, this is what he said. Whatever weight may be ascribed to the opinions of the fathers, and whatever grounds the weight that is ascribed to them may be made to rest, no one disputes the propriety and the importance of ascertaining, as far as we can, what their views really were. And well, most theologians in modern times, whatever opinions they may entertain upon the general question of the deference to be paid to the fathers, have shown some desire to exhibit in their own behalf the testimony of the early church. I mean, so in other words, he's saying even Protestants, where they could quote early church fathers in support of their position, have done so. You don't have to be Catholic to want to be able to do that, okay? Whenever it could, with any plausibility, be adduced. And this has given rise to a great deal of learned, voluminous, and often intricate and wearisome discussion. Both in these more ancient and in more modern times, men have acted upon a notion more or less distinctly conceived and more or less earnestly maintained that the fact of a doctrine or system of doctrines having been held by the early church afforded some presumption that it had been taught by the apostles. As a general position, this may perhaps be admitted to be true, but it needs to be very cautiously applied and to be restricted within very narrow limits. Okay? Now, he's right, of course. You know that that although all of us can appreciate the fact that if you could really prove that the early church was premillennial almost to a man, that that would probably mean that the apostles must have taught it. But still, you gotta want to be careful before you swallow that too wholeheartedly, because you know the early church was Episcopalian almost to a man. And do you want to become an Episcopalian? That is to say, the early church was ruled by bishops. Bishops as distinguished from elders. Bishops as ruling over not just one, but many churches, and with other church officers under them. Now, and Anglicans have made a great deal of hay with the fact that that they can go back and prove that, say, the church in Antioch in Syria had a bishop around the year 107, a bishop as opposed to being ruled by a board of presbyters. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said about that, okay? But I'm just saying we need to be careful about this argument, okay, because it can lead a lot of places you might not really want to go, and which pretty clearly contradict the plain teaching of the New Testament, okay? But nonetheless, still, we've got to admit that it's impressive. And so it's necessary for me to say now that Feinberg's statement to say is an extravagant, and I'm using these words really carefully, is an extravagant overstatement and at best a half-truth. Okay, and I'm going to tell you why I say that now. It's difficult to understand how Feinberg has so plainly distorted the facts of early church history. Part of his problem may be that he has assumed that prophetic views often associated with premillennialism infallibly prove that their authors were premillennialist. In other words, he may have in his mind that premillennialists, well, let's just believe in the Antichrist, that premillennialists believe in the imminent return of Christ. And so any place he finds belief in an Antichrist or belief in the imminent return of Christ, he finds premillennialism. But, you know, a lot of people believe those things besides premillennialists. And so the argument is fallacious, you know, that kind of argument by association. So the question is not whether the apostolic fathers taught in some sense the doctrine of the imminent return of Christ or the doctrine of the personal Antichrist. Both the Didache, which that's the terminology used for a very early church, Christian book, usually associated with the apostolic fathers. The Didache is teaching. It's the teaching of the 12 apostles. It clearly was not written by the 12 apostles, but that's what it's called. Chapter 16 and the Epistle of Barnabas, again, not really written by Barnabas. And chapters 4 and 15 teach the doctrine of a personal Antichrist. Both these points have historically been associated with premillennialism, and it may be the presence of these views in the early fathers that is partially responsible for the reputation that they have of being premillennial. The doctrines of an imminent return of Christ and the personal Antichrist, however, are adopted by many who are not premillennial. They are held today, for instance, by many that would call themselves amillennial. And that's a term that we'll define in a minute. The essence of premillennialism is not the doctrine of the imminence of Christ's return. It is not the doctrine of a personal antichrist. It is rather the doctrine of a millennial reign following Christ's return and before the eternal state. That's the essence of the doctrine. And that's what Feinberg has to prove people held. Now, the extravagance of Feinberg's statement will be best seen by an examination of premillennialism in the early church. We're going to look at its early emergence, its subsequent growth, and its final withering. Okay? Early emergence. Only two of the earliest are apostolic fathers, and usually people say there are eight or nine of them, just for your information. Only two of the earliest or apostolic fathers may with any evidence be called, be claimed for premillennialism. And those two are Papias and the person, whoever he was, who wrote the Epistle of Barnabas. The Epistle of Barnabas is usually dated from about the year 130, 135. The quotations from Papias, well, we don't have any books by Papias. The only reason we know Papias as a premillennialist is that a later church history cites him as one, and we'll talk about that. Papias, according to the very first church history that we have from a man by the name of Eusebius of Caesarea, Papias claimed to have heard the Apostle John and to have been a friend of the martyr Polycarp. He is said, by that same Eusebius, to have written five books in which he recorded statements of John and other early disciples. Now, just in case you're wondering, none of those books survive. But there are excerpts of them recorded in Eusebius' church history. And he lived from about 260 to 340, and I think his church history is dated about 320 or 325. Now, Eusebius intersperses his own comments throughout his excerpts of Papias. And he asserts that Papias was a premillennialist. The actual excerpts of Papias that he gives don't actually say that explicitly. They do say enough things that look like it and sound like early premillennialism that people usually take it for granted that Eusebius was right. Here's Eusebius' comment about Papias, and it's very noteworthy and very important, and we're going to see things like it in a number of places in the history of early premillennialism. Here's what he says. The same person, Papias that is, moreover, has set down other things. Let me see if I can give you just a little bit more of this. Yeah, that's probably, okay, so that'll work. The same person, moreover, set down other things as coming to him from unwritten tradition. Amongst these, some strange parables and instructions of the Savior, and some other things of a more fabulous nature. Now, fabulous here doesn't have a positive connotation, you understand. By fabulous, he means fable-like, okay? Amongst these, he says that there will be a millennium after the resurrection from the dead when the personal reign of Christ will be established on earth. Now, just stop. If you had to judge if Eusebius was a premillennialist from what he just said, what would you say? No. He thinks that this idea of a millennium after Christ comes back is fabulous. In the bad sense of the word, okay? That's how other people read Eusebius as well. He says Papias was a premillennialist, but he doesn't seem to think that that is very impressive. So, and other things about this statement are interesting. Eusebius' statement makes clear that he was not impressed by Papias' claim that he got his stuff, to use the modern jargon, from the apostles. Indeed, all the reader has to do is read the excerpts from Papias in Eusebius' church history. They're in a footnote, and he will no doubt come to share Eusebius' opinion. Oh, you'd like to know. Well, let's see. Did I put all this stuff in a footnote? Oh. No, you're going to have to go to the Ante-Nicene Fathers, Volume 1, and look at pages 153 and 54 to see that stuff. But take my word for it. When Eusebius describes what he says as fabulous, it's not just his premillennialism, it's the entire way he talks about the millennium that is really far out. Anyway, even for a premillennialist, let me put it that way. Another interesting feature of Eusebius' comment is that it makes clear that he regarded Papias' premillennialism as fabulous. It seems clear from this that Eusebius himself was not a premillennialist. This is our first indication that Feinberg's statement about the early church being premillennial to a man in its first three centuries is really unwarranted. The other apostolic father, by the way, apostolic father, I use this jargon. You know what an apostolic father technically is? Maybe I ought to define that. An apostolic father is... actually refers not so much to men as to writings, okay? The apostle, you know the early tradition about when the apostle John died, and he was the last living apostle. He died in, anybody know, generally speaking? About the year 95 to 100, okay, let's just be general about it. He was the last living apostle. He died, there's his tombstone, John. He died right there, okay? Now, the writings of the apostolic fathers are writings of men whose lifespans overlapped apostles. Okay? Now, a lot of them you really have to guess about, and some of them are pseudepigraphical. They've been given names that aren't really who wrote them, like the Epistle of Barnabas. Wasn't really written by Barnabas. So some of them are, we know who wrote them, and at least tradition and scholarly study makes clear that some of these men's lifespans overlap those of the apostles. For instance, we shouldn't do things from memory, but Polycarp. Polycarp is the author of one of the writings of the apostolic fathers. Polycarp, my memory serves me, and this is close if it's not absolutely correct, died in 156. I'm going to say 154. Anyway, he died in 154, and we are told in the book written at the time of his death, Martyrdom of Polycarp, that he was around 84. So you subtract 84 from 154, you get the year 70. Okay? Which means that the tradition that he actually heard the Apostle John preach in Asia Minor, where he grew up, is credible, okay? So he's an apostolic father because his lifespan overlaps those of the apostles. Similarly, Clement and the writing First Clement is on all hands regarded generally as the Clement mentioned in the New Testament in Philippians chapter 4. He was an early elder in the church at Rome, wrote his book in the year 97, First Clement's Epistle to the Corinthians. Okay? And he is in all likelihood, therefore his lifespan certainly did overlap those of the apostles. The other one that's pretty authentic is Ignatius. All those Catholic schools and churches and colleges named Ignatius are named after this guy. He was the bishop of Antioch in Syria. And he died, depending on whose story you believe, either in the year 107 or 116. So clearly, again, the seven epistles of Ignatius were writings of a man whose lifespan overlapped those of the apostles. Okay? So that's what an apostolic father is. The Epistle of Barnabas is classed as that because it's dated from about the year 131. So whoever wrote it certainly lived close to the time of the apostles if his lifespan didn't overlap it. Now, one of the problems in reading early Christian literature is, quite frankly, some of its you're going to be really disappointed. You go back and read the Apostolic Fathers and think you're going to get something that sounds like the New Testament, you're going to be really disappointed. Okay? I'll just tell you. They're interesting stuff, and there's a lot to be learned, okay? But don't expect the New Testament, and don't expect apostles. There's kind of a cliff phenomena when you come to the Apostolic Fathers, which in one sense is a indirect attestation of the inspiration of the New Testament, because these guys weren't inspired. And even though they intended to follow the apostles, sometimes what they said was, well, take this statement from the epistle to the Barnabas. Andrew, there are no big words in here. It's just going to be hard to follow his train of thought. Can you read that for us? I know it's kind of Andrew Thornquist at this point I'm talking to.
The whole thing?
Yeah, because this is just going to give you an example of what some of these early Apostolic Fathers' writings is like, and you should get a taste of it, since I haven't quoted Papias to you. Okay. Go ahead.
Further, also, it is written concerning the Sabbath in the Decalogue, which the Lord spoke face to face to Moses on Mount Sinai, and sanctify ye the Sabbath of the Lord with clean hands and a pure heart. And he says that in another place, if my sons keep the Sabbath, then I will cause my mercy to rest upon them. The Sabbath is mentioned at the beginning of the creation thus, and God made in 6 days the works of his hands, and made an end on the seventh day, and rested on it, and sanctified it. Attend, my children, to the meaning of this expression. He finished in 6 days. This implieth that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years, for a day is with him 1,000 years.
Just stop right there. How many of you have ever heard anybody say that history is going to be like the creation week, 6,000 years? You heard that? Well, it's really old. I'm not saying it's biblical, but it's really old, and you're hearing it here for the first time in church history in the Epistle of Barnabas. Go ahead.
And he himself testifieth, saying, behold, today will be as 1,000 years. Therefore, my children, in 6 days, that is, in 6,000 years, all things will be finished. And he rested on the seventh day. This meaneth, when his son coming again shall destroy the time of the wicked man, and judge the ungodly, and change the sun, and the moon, and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Moreover, he says, thou shalt sanctify it with pure hands and a pure heart. If, therefore, anyone can now sanctify the day which God hath sanctified, except he is pure in heart in all things, we are deceived. Behold, therefore, certainly then, one properly resting sanctifies it, when we ourselves, having received the promise, wickedness no longer existing, and all things having been made new by the Lord, shall be able to work righteousness. Then we shall be able to sanctify it, having been first sanctified ourselves. Further, he says, your new moons and your Sabbaths I cannot endure. Ye perceive how he speaks. Your present Sabbaths are not acceptable to me, but that is which I have made, namely this, when giving rest to all things, I shall make a beginning of the eighth day, that is, a beginning of another world. Wherefore also we keep the eighth day with joyfulness, the day also on which Jesus rose again from the dead, and when he had manifested himself, he ascended into the heavens.
Okay. Now this is chapter 15 of the Epistle of Barnabas is really important in a lot of different respects that are not eschatological. For instance, it's one of our first references, not the first, but one of the first references to the Christian observance of the first day of the week, or what's called here the eighth day. But I hope you'd agree, after having heard Andrew read it, that's a very complex passage. It's on the basis of this passage that some people claim that the author of the Epistle of Barnabas was a premillennialist. Now, I can see how they get that out of it, but I also have to tell you, I don't think this passage is really that clear about a lot of different things. And I think just reading it maybe will help you see this. Superficially read, it has a premillennial ring. There's the seventh day, but then it becomes the eighth day, and what's the difference? It's hard to tell. And he also speaks of the destruction of the wicked man, that is to say, the Antichrist by the second coming of Christ, speaks of the judgment of the ungodly and the rest of the Messiah on that seventh day. But W.J. Greer, in his book entitled, what is it entitled? Sorry, I'm going, it's all the way down here, I had to go to get it. The Momentous Event, sorry. Has this to say. Barnabas' scheme of history was patterned on the week of creation in Genesis 1. The expression, he finished in 6 days, means, he says, that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years. The expression, he rested on the seventh day, contains the prophetic meaning that when Christ coming again shall destroy the time of the wicked man and judge the ungodly and change the sun and the moon and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Premillenarians take this seventh day of the millennium, but what premillenarian is willing to admit that the millennium is ushered in by the judgment of the ungodly, as Barnabas states? According to the epistle of Barnabas, the seventh day will not come till wickedness is no longer existing and all things have been made new, which is a real problem for a premillennial interpretation of Revelation 20, because it's clear that in Revelation 20, wickedness does still exist in the millennium. Okay? The eighth day is the beginning of another world, but also distinction seems to be done away between the seventh and the eighth day when Barnabas says that the Lord, in giving rest to all things, which happens on the seventh day, makes the beginning of the eighth day, that is, the beginning of another world. It's clear, at any rate, that Barnabas shuts out the possibility of an earthly millennium in which unregenerate men will be under the reign of Christ. It's perfectly clear, too, that he holds, as all others of his time, that Christians and not Jews are the heirs of the covenant. It is interesting to note that D.H. Crominga, a premillenarian, says the presumption is that Barnabas was what we nowadays call an amillennialist, in the book Millennium in the Church, page 33. Well, Greer's exposition of this difficult passage surely makes an amillennial interpretation of it possible and perhaps necessary. But what is the meaning of this term, amillennialism, and what was the view of Eusebius, the early church father, that rejected the premillennialism of Papias? Well, that brings us to discuss this position, which we're going to discover was also widely held in the early church, called amillennialism. The word literally means, if you trace it back to its origins, no millennium. Amillennialists do not, of course, however, deny that the Bible in Revelation 20 teaches a thousand-year reign of Christ. The point of this term is that they do not believe in a future thousand-year reign of Christ after his return. They don't believe in a future golden age. They believe, rather, that this reign is a figurative reference to the present gospel age. The return of Christ, then, results not in the millennium, but in the final judgment in the eternal state. Now, let me just comment further. Some amillennialists have said we don't like to be called amillennialists because we believe in a millennium. We just don't believe that the millennium takes place after the second coming of Christ, which is true. And so you can understand why some people have said this isn't a very good name for our position. But are you familiar with the difference between the denotation of a word and the connotation of a word? It's denotation is the precise technical definition of a word. Okay? Connotation has to do with the halo meanings that come to be associated with a certain word. Okay? Now, this is the problem with the term millennium. Millennium itself simply means a period of 1,000 years. And so in one sense, no Bible believer could be an amillennialist. No millennium. Because everybody, including all amillennialists, believe in Revelation 20 and believe that it predicts there a thousand-year period of time. So there's no way you can be a Bible believer. And in terms of the denotation of the term millennium, not believe in the millennium. This is there in Revelation 20, and everybody can see it. The problem is, however, and this is, I think, where the term amillennialism came from. The problem is, millennium, in the way that it's used, and in terms of the things it's associated with, doesn't merely mean 1,000 years or 1,000-year period of time, does it? When you hear the term millennium, what does it connote? What ideas is it associated with? That's a real question, not rhetorical. Besides 1,000-year period of time, doesn't it connote, and isn't it associated with other ideas when you hear it? Like a long time. But what kind of time is a millennium? What?
It's in place.
There's a rule in place. Okay, it's associated with Christ's rule. What else?
New age.
A new age? New in what respects?
Different reign, like he was talking about.
Yeah. But the character of it. Would you agree with me if I said that the term millennium is usually associated with the idea of a golden age, a period of time in which righteousness and peace and prosperity characterize the world? Well, I think that those are the connotations of the word millennium. Now, in terms of, therefore, a great 1,000-year period of time, or even a long period of time, of righteousness, peace, and prosperity before the end of the world, or even after Christ comes back, before the eternal state? Well, in the sense of that, that's where the idea of amillennial comes from, because amillennialists don't believe in that. They don't believe in that kind of golden age. And so, depending whether you take the denotation of the word, simply a 1,000-year period of time, or the connotation, golden age of righteousness, peace, and prosperity, depending on how you define the term millennium is going to make a difference on whether you want, or I want, or anyone wants, perhaps, to be called an amillennialist. Anyway, look at the chart. You understand what I'm saying there? So I don't mind the word amillennialism, but I take it as a rejection of the idea of a golden age of righteousness, peace, and prosperity before the eternal state. Okay? But this is amillennialism. Old covenant, resurrection of Christ. But now the gospel age is equivalent to the millennium. The 1,000-year period of time is taken as referring to the period of time between Christ's first and second advents, between his resurrection and his return. And at Christ's return, you have, well, the resurrection and the judgment of the ungodly, and this ushers in the eternal state. Well, the righteous go away into eternal life, the wicked into eternal punishment, and that's it. Okay? That's amillennialism, very simply stated, right? Questions? Well, to make a long story short, if this plausible, I think it's plausible anyway, amillennial interpretation of Barnabas, or whoever Barnabas was, is adopted or even entertained as possible, then the only clear evidence for premillennialism in the earliest fathers, the apostolic fathers, is the highly questionable witness of Papias. All the other fathers are really silent on the subject of premillennialism. There are 9 or 10 different classes of writings that are classed as apostolic fathers. Only 2 of them are even arguably saying anything about premillennialism. And Barnabas is really highly questionable whether that's really his position or not. Papias, we will grant that he was. But no, that's not true in the next period of time. And so we got to come here to the subsequent growth.
Thank you for listening to the Weekly Discourse. If you've been blessed by this week's discourse, please consider subscribing to the Man of God Network so that you can continue to be blessed with resources like these. If you'd like to learn more about Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, visit us at cbtseminary.org.